In the Pines by Carl Edward Wagner. Carl Edward Wagner is one of the most accomplished prose stylists among modern writers of horror and supernatural fiction. Among contemporary practitioners of the ceremonial ghost story, in the opinion of Twilight Zone magazine, Carl Edward Wagner is unusual in combining the psychological realism of Ramsay Campbell with the hierophantic pomp of a bishop in a play by Jean Genet. This is one of his finest, most sophisticated ghost stories. Prologue. There is an atmosphere of unutterable loneliness that haunts any ruin, a feeling particularly evident in those places once given over to the lighter emotions. Wander over the littered grounds of an abandoned amusement park and feel the overwhelming presence of desolation. Flimsy booths with awnings tattered in the wind, rotting heaps of sun-bleached papier-mâché, crumbling timbers of a roller coaster thrust upward through the jungle of weeds and debris, like ribs of some titanic unburied skeleton. The wind blows colder there, the sun seems dimmer. Ghosts of laughter, lost strains of raucous music can almost be heard. Speak and your voice sounds strangely loud, and yet curiously smothered. Or tour a neglected formal garden with its termite-riddled arbors and gazebo. The lily pond is drained, choked with weeds and refuse. Only a few flowers or shrubs poke miserably through the rank undergrowth. Dense cloths of weeds and vines overrun the paths and statuary. Here and there a shrub, a rambling rose, has grown into a wild, misshapen tangle. The flowers offer anemic blooms where no hand gathers, no eye admires. No birds sing in that uncanny hush. Such places are lairs of inconsolable gloom. After the brighter spirits have departed, shadows of despair and oppression assume their place. The area has been drained of its ability to support any further light emotion. And now, like weeds on eroded soil, only the darker sentiments can take root and flourish. These places are best left to the loneliness of their grief. The road that climbed pine-hooded slopes was winding and narrow, treacherous with deep ruts and large stones. County work crews seldom came this far, and rains of many seasons had left the unpaved road with the contour of a dry stream bed. In late afternoon sunlight, the dusty Chevy bounced and rattled its cautious ascent of the pine-covered ridge. A rock outcropping struck its undercarriage and grated harshly. Janet caught her breath but said nothing. Gerard Randall risked a quick glance from the wheel to note her tense fright. He scowled and concentrated on driving. Accustomed to wide, straight lanes of modern highway, Randall found this steep country road with its diabolical curves a nightmare. Rains had long since washed out whatever shoulder there was, and he watched in sick fascination as the road disappeared completely, all too few inches from his jolting wheels. "Can you see roads like this in Ohio?" he snorted, and wondered what would happen should two cars meet. With traffic almost non-existent, that seemed unlikely. At any rate, he was barely crawling, as a light car wallowed over the rutted bed. Once again, he felt a pang of regret for the Buick and its solid feel. But now life was strictly economy class. The road made an impossible hairpin, so that Gerald had to stop the car to back and fill. He swore silently, keeping his anger to himself. What had this road been designed for anyway? Didn't these Tennessee hillbillies drive cars? The long drive from Columbus had been difficult. From wide interstate highway, the roads had steadily retrogressed down the evolutionary ladder. Until now, he followed a trail Davy Crockett would have scorned. Their silence had been awkward, but conversation was a greater strain. Instead, he turned up the radio and pretended not to notice Janet's tight-faced nervousness. For miles now, the radio had blared out twangy country music from the small town stations along their route. When they left the paved road, it faded into static. They were passing vacation cabins now, so he paid careful attention. "Help me find the place, Janet," he said levelly. "If we miss it, I'll never get turned around." One of the last ones on the road, the agent in Maryville had told them when they stopped for the key. On the left, a good coat of green paint with red fuel oil and water tanks in front. The sign over the door would read "The Crow's Nest" in red and white. Couldn't be missed. "I hope it's clean," Janet offered hesitantly. "Some of these look so run down." "True enough," Jerry admitted. A few cabins were in good condition. Fresh paint, aluminum screens, new car alongside. But most were half fallen apart, sagging wooden boxes perched on precarious stilts along the steep mountainside. A few had tumbled down the slope, pitiful heaps of crumpled and rotting timbers. Not encouraging. He voiced his annoyance. "So most of these places are 50 years old? What did you think $75 a month would get you for a mountain cabin? In Gatlinburg, we pay this much for a night." Her face drew tighter, and her eyes looked damp. She was assuming her wounded martyr expression. Jerry braced himself for the now familiar crisis. "Please, God, not now, not here." "There it is," he pointed suddenly. "Let's see if there's room to pull off the road." Cautiously, he edged the Chevy into a parking area beside the cabin. Janet's face grew keen with interest. "It doesn't look too bad," she observed hopefully. Jerry eyed the structure in quick appraisal. No, it doesn't," he conceded, "at least from the outside." The Crow's Nest was a typical mountain cabin from the early 20s. Days when this had been a major resort area, it clung to the steep slope with one end resting on the bank just below the road, while an arrangement of wooden posts supported the sections jutting out from the mountain. Its unlovely design was that of a stack of boxes anchored to the ridge. The top floor, one level with the road, was a large square. Underneath was a rectangle about 2/3 the width of the first. The bottom floor was an even narrower rectangle. Rusty screen and closed porches running the length of each level, on the side overlooking the valley. "Well, we can't complain about the view," Jerry offered. "There's 3 porches to choose from. Hope it's not too drafty for you. Well, come on, you can explore while I unload stuff." Getting out, he gratefully stretched his long body, then reached in. "Make it okay?" he inquired solicitously. She pulled herself erect unsteadily, tugging hard on his arm and gripping the door with the other hand. Jerry unloaded her walker, then went to unlock the cabin, while Janet hobbled painfully across the pine needle carpet to the door. Inside, she smiled. "Oh, Jerry, it looks so cozy. I know we'll be happy together here." "I hope so, darling," he brightened. The screen door slammed shut on squalling hinges. Janet was exhausted and went to bed early. Jerry had not felt like sleep. The ordeal of driving had left his nerves on edge, and the strange surroundings made him restless. Instead, he settled down in one of the huge rocking chairs, propped his feet on the edge of the porch screen, and enjoyed the mountain night. Idly, his fingers flicked the bottle caps nailed to the wide wooden armrest while he thoughtfully nursed a scotch and soda. He had brought several fifths down with him. The nearest liquor store would be Knoxville, and Tennessee liquor prices were terrible. He grimaced. Good scotch was another luxury he could no longer afford. The mountain breeze was cool and clean, and the night's silence astonished him. Dimly, he could hear the whine, see the flicker of light as an occasional car passed along the highway in the valley far below. The house uttered soft groans and squeaks in the darkness, and the rocker answered with a rhythmic creak. From outside came the sounds of creatures of the forest night. Crickets, tree frogs, shrill insect calls, mice, flying squirrels made soft rustlings in the quiet. An owl called from the distance, and a whippoorwill. Overlying all was the whisper of the pines. Jerry had often heard the expression, but until now he had never understood that pines actually do whisper, soft, soothing whisper in the night, but a sound so cold, so lonely. Even bad scotch gets better with each drink. Maybe not Chivas Regal, but it does the job. Jerry rocked softly, sipped slowly, glass after glass. The night was soothing. Tension slipped from his overstrung nerves. Half in dream, he brooded over the turn his life had taken. God, it had all seemed so secure, settled. His wife, their son, a rising position with a firm, good car, good house, good neighborhood, country club, the right friends, bright young man already halfway up the ladder to the top. Then a woman's inattention, a flaming crash, only a split second to destroy everything. The funeral, weeks of visits to the hospital, the lawsuit, and its cruel joke of an insurance executive whose own policy was inadequate. All of it destroyed. A comfortable, well-ordered existence torn to twisted wreckage. He could never return to the old life, despite the sincere best wishes of embarrassed friends, the concerned expressions of doctors who warned him about the emotional shock he had suffered. Maybe it would have been best if he had been in the car, if he had died in the wreckage of his life. No, that was a death wish. Part of the warnings of those concerned doctors after that scene in the hospital. Part of their reasons for urging this vacation upon him. You both have scars that will have to heal. Cherry laughed softly at the memory of the psychiatrist's attempt to talk with him. In the stillness of the dark cabin, his laughter was ghastly. He checked the bottle and noted it was almost empty. Drunk, by God. He supposed he should start bawling in his glass. Yes, doctor, worry about me. Lose a little sleep in your $300,000 home. God knows how I've waited for the nights to end since then. Time for bed. Try out that musty old mattress. He drew in a deep lungful of the mountain air. Curious fragrance he had not noticed before. Probably some mountain flower, something that smelled like jasmine. The cabin stairs were too treacherous for Janet, and so Jerry had to carry her, and then both nearly fell. But Janet insisted on exploring each drafty level of the old place as soon as late breakfast was cleared. Hungover, Jerry reluctantly joined the game. Strange how frail she seemed in his arms. She had always been so solid. Maybe if she'd exercise her legs more, like the doctors had told her to do. The cabin was in reasonable repair, but not much more. The floor sagged in places, and the roof showed signs of having leaked. But by and large, everything seemed sound. Squirrels had slipped in and chewed up some of the furnishings. The furniture, always cheap, beat up, caught in the limbo somewhere between antique and junk. None of it had captured the fancy of the countless prowlers who had broken in over the years. Disreputable iron rail beds with collapsed springs and dirty mattresses, scarred tables and cheap dressers with many layers of paint, boxes and trunks of discarded items, a grimy bookshelf with several Edgar Wallace mysteries, a copy of Fox's Trail of the Lonesome Pine, a Bible, odd volumes of Reader's Digest condensed books, other nondescript items. Janet delightedly pawed through each new trove, and Jerry became interested despite himself. He joined her laughter when one drawer yielded a bedraggled two-piece man's swimming costume. The first level included the kitchen with its ancient appliances, two bedrooms, a bathroom with an old chemical toilet, and a large open area for dining or sitting. Below were two more bedrooms and a narrower open space along the screened front. The lowermost level was a narrow porch with several army bunks and a room at one end that had once been a bar. The insubstantial post that supported the cabin were a good 12 feet high at the far end, so that there was a large dry storage area underneath. This had been stuffed with boxes and piles of junk not worth the effort of hauling away. Here Jerry returned after a light lunch. Janet was tired and wanted to lie down. The disorder was fantastic, a clutter of discarded trivia decades old. Jerry had an appreciation for the cash value of an antique, and with a treasure hunter's enthusiasm, he rummaged through the tottering stacks of lost years. More junk than any attic would attempt. Broken chairs, cracked dishes, boxes of mason jars, heaps of newspapers, rusty tools, old tires, a wheelless bicycle, fishing poles, anything. Doggedly, he worked his way from pile to pile, covered with a paste of sweat, red dust, and spider web. Once he found a scorpion under a wooden box, and remembered that Black Widow spiders, too, liked these places. Maybe there were snakes, but he paid no more attention to such misgivings than to the dirt, although a year ago he would not have braved either, just to rifle through old junk. It had been profitable so far. He had pulled out a tool chest in case he felt up to making repairs. There was a stack of crumbling pulp magazines, Argosy, Black Mask, Doc Savage, Weird Tales, and others that would provide a few laughs. A crockery jug, just like the moonshine jugs in the cartoons, would make a nice lamp. An old copper lantern might be a nice antique, along with a cane-bottom chair. Some of these picture frames might be valuable. He stopped. Against one post leaned a stack of old pictures, mostly mountain scenes and calendar cutouts behind glass opaque with dirt. But as he shuffled through them, one picture suddenly caught his eye. It was an original oil painting. He saw on closer examination and did not look quite finished. For a moment he remembered stories of undiscovered masterpieces, but laughed the thought aside. Carefully he blew away loose dust. Sandwiched between several larger frames, the canvas was undamaged. Critically, he held it to the yellow sunlight. The picture caught him, drew his attention in a manner he had never experienced. Inexplicable. Art had never meant anything to him, aside from a few tasteful reproductions dutifully purchased to fill wall space. A woman's portrait, nothing more, curiously blurred as if the oils were somewhat translucent. Was it unfinished or was it an attempt at impressionism? She wore a simple green frock, a light summer outfit stylish in the '20s. Her auburn hair was cut in a short bob popular then, almost in keeping with the latest styles, but for an indefinable air that proclaimed an older period. It was a lonely picture. She stood against the backdrop of dark pines, cold and lonely about her. There was a delicacy about her, and illogically an impression of strength. The face was difficult. Its mood seemed altered at each glance. Indefinable. Sensuous mouth. Did it smile, or was there sorrow? Perhaps half open in anticipation of a kiss or a cry. The eyes, soft blue, or did they glow? Did they express longing, pain, or were they hungry eyes, eyes alight with triumph? Lonely eyes, lonely face, a lonely picture. A song long forgotten came to his mind. In the pines, where the sun never shines, and I shiver when the wind blows cold. He did shiver then. Sun falling, the mountain wind blew cold through the pines. How long had he been staring at the portrait? Struck with a chill beyond that of the wind, Cherry cradled his fine and cautious hands and started back up the dusty bank. Janet was in a cheerful mood for a change, not even a complaint about being ignored most of the afternoon. "Well, let's see what goodies you've brought up from the basement," she laughed, and glanced at the picture. "Oh, there's Twiggy." Jerry hauled camp. "Look, an original piece of nostalgia." He frowned, suddenly offended by her gaiety. In view of the profound impression the picture had made, laughter seemed irreverent. I thought it was kind of nice myself. Thought I'd hang it up, maybe. Can't you just feel the loneliness of it? She gave him a hopeless look. Oh, wow, you're serious. Hang that old thing up? Jerry, you're kidding. Look how silly she looks. He glanced at her pre-faded bell-bottoms and tank top. Maybe that will look silly in a few years, too. I thought you liked these. She inspected herself in faint concern, wondering if she had gotten too thin. No, Jerry was just being pettish. Well, let me take a good look at your treasure. She studied the picture with a professional attitude. On Tuesday afternoons, she had taken art lessons along with several of her friends. The artist is really just too romantic. See, no expression, no depth to a subject. Pale girl against dark woods. It's corny. Too much background for a portrait, and that dress dates it too severely to be idealized. Not even a good landscape. His greens are overused and too obvious. His light is all wrong. And there's certainly no imagination with all those dark colors. Is it supposed to be night or day? Jerry bit his lip in annoyance. Snotty little dilettante. He wished he knew enough about art to tear apart her prattling criticism. This is pretty typical of the sort of modeling trash they turned out in the 20s. Probably some amateur on vacation here did it of his girlfriend, and she had enough taste to leave it behind. Let's see. It's signed here on the corner. E. Pittman, 1951. 1951? That's funny, she finished awkwardly. Jerry's mustache twitched sarcastically. And when did they make you valedictorian of your art class? That gossip session where bored housewives can splash on gobs of paint and call it a subtle interplay of neo-garbage? That stung. Oh, stop sulking. So I insulted your male ego because I don't care for your little twiggy of the woods. Because you're too damn insensitive to get into the mood of this painting. Why had she gotten him so riled over an old picture? Because you don't feel the... Damn. How do art critics choose their phrases? Because you're jealous over a portrait of a beautiful woman. What the hell sense did that make? You're not hanging that piece of junk up here. Now she was mad at him. Her lips made a white line across her blonde face. No, no, I'm not. Not where you can sneer at her. I'll hang her up downstairs. Way downstairs, I hope, she shouted after him, close to tears now, and things had been going so well. Dinner had been awkward, both sheepish but sulking. Apologies meant but left unspoken, quarrels ignored but not forgotten. He left her fiddling with a portable TV afterward, making the excuse that he wanted to read without distraction. Downstairs he had replenished the old bar. The portrait hung against the wall, watching him. In cleaning it, he had noticed the name Renee, scrawled at the top. Maybe the artist's name? No, that was E. Pittman. Probably the title, then. Name suited her well. Mind if I have a drink, Renee? He murmured. Wife says I have a few too many, a bit too often. Cliché for the day. Bitter hero drowns his grief in booze. The eyes stared back at him. In pity, loneliness, hunger. How lost she looked. Jerry flipped on the lopsided floor lamp and settled down to read some of the pulps he had resurrected. God, how ingenious the stuff was. Were people ever so naive? He wondered how James Bond would appear to readers back then. Bugs slipped through the rusty screen and swarmed to the light. Buzzed through his ears, plopped on the pages, fell on his drink. In vexation, he finally clicked the lamp off. His gaze was drawn back to the portrait, visible through the darkness by the glow of the bar light. He considered it with a careful patience four double shots of scotch can bestow. Who was she, this Renee? She seemed too real to be only an artist's imagination. But it was curious that an artist of the 50s should paint a girl of the 20s. Had she once sat here on this porch and listened to the same wind? this cold, lonesome wind in the pines. God. Getting sentimental from scotch. Mellow over a painting that a few months back he'd have laughed at. He closed his eyes wearily and concentrated on the night, letting its ancient spell wash over him. The cool velvet soft night. Pines whispering in the darkness, the sound of loneliness. And Jerry realized he had become a very lonely man. A lost soul adrift in the darkness of the pines. Again came the faint scent of jasmine. Haunting perfume. Jasmine, antique like this cabin, worn by enchantresses of another age. Fragrance lingering from dead years. Delicate floral scent worn when beauty was caressed by silken gowns garlanded with pearls, glinted with lacquered nails. Gone now, vanquished by synthetics. Today a woman clothed, adorned, perfumed herself with coal tar and cellulose. No wonder femininity had declined. He breathed a rare fragrance, the cool night somewhere, between waking and dreaming. Faintly he heard the rustle of silk behind him, a sound separate from the whisper of the pines, a cold breath on his neck, apart from the mountain breeze, like the elusive scent of jasmine, sensations alien to the night, yet part of it. The wind brushed his dark hair, stroked his damp forehead, almost as if a cool, delicate hand soothed the lines of pain. He sighed, almost a shudder. Tension softened, days of anguish lost their sting. A feeling of inexpressible contentment stole over him. Anticipation of ecstasy came to him. He parted his lips in a smile of dreamy delight. Renee, the sigh escaped him unbidden. It seemed that another's lips hovered close to his own. Sleep came to him then. The sign announced, Pennybacker's Grocery, drink Coca-Cola. Maryville had modern supermarkets, and ordinarily Jerry would have driven the extra distance. But today the country grocery with its old-fashioned general store atmosphere appealed to him, and it was close by. The building was old. In front stood two battered gas pumps. Of some local brand. A long peaked roof overhung to form a sheltered enclosure between gas pumps and storefront. Two wooden benches guarded the doorway. Their engraved invitation to drink Royal Crown Cola was almost obliterated by countless carved initials and years of friction from overalls. The paint was starting to peel and the windows were none too clean. Rusty advertising signed, and a year's growth of posters made it a faded patchwork of the exterior. Inside was packed, more merchandise than there seemed floor space for. Strange brands abounded on the crowded shelves. Fresh produce from local farms stood in open baskets. Cuts of meat were displayed within a glass counter. Odd items of hardware, clothing, medicines, tackle augmented the fantastic clutter. Here was a true general store without the artificial quaintness of the counterfeit country stores of Gatlinburg's tourist traps. Grocery buying was something of an adventure, and Jerry was glad Janet had not come along to quarrel over selections. A display of knives caught his eye as he waited for the proprietor to total his purchases on a clattering adding machine. Among the other pocket knives, he recognized the familiar shape of a Barlow knife. "Is that a real Barlow or a Japanese copy?" he asked. The storekeeper looked up sharply. "No, sir. Those knives are everyone made in America. For your really quality knife, you want your American one every time. Though there's some likes the German. Take them case knives there. Now you can't ask for a better knife. Lots of folks swear by a case knife. Now that Barlow's a fine one, too. It's a Camillus, and as fine a knife as any you could have bought 50 years ago. Cost you just $4. Want to see one?" Jerry tossed the stubby knife in his palm and decided to buy it. He had never carried a penknife, and this one was too bulky for his pocket, still a good souvenir. The storekeeper was disposed to talk, and the knife led to a rambling conversation. Lonzo Pennybacker had run this store since the Depression. His uncle had built the place about the time of the Great War and the gas pumps were some of the first in the area. Lonzo was interested to learn that Jerry was from Columbus. Two of his cousins had family up around there, although he supposed Jerry wouldn't know them. No, Jerry guessed he didn't. Lonzo's expression was peculiar when Jerry mentioned he had rented the crow's nest. "So they've got somebody to stay in the old Reagan place again," he reflected. "Oh?" Jerry's bushy eyebrows rose. "Why do you say that? Is the place haunted or something?" Pennybacker scratched his pointed chin pensively. "Hance? No. Don't think you can say that rightly. Far as I know, nobody's ever seen no Hance around the old Reagan place. If it's Hance now, you could have seen as many as you'd care for in the old Griffin house. Everybody knew it was for sure haunted. Of course, it burned down in 61. No, far as I know, the Reagan place ain't haunted. It's just what they call unlucky." "Unlucky? How do you mean that?" Jerry wondered if he should laugh. Lonzo finished packing the groceries before answering. "Well, sir, I was just through schooling back in 22 when David Reagan built the crow's nest. He was a mine owner out of Greenville and a wealthy man as we counted them in those days. Built the place as a honeymoon cabin for him and his wife. Fine, handsome young lady, I can remember. She was maybe 20 years younger than David Reagan, he being in his 40s and sort of stout. Renee, though, what a mighty prettysome girl." "Renee?" "Renee, that was her name. Quite a looker. Wore her hair bobbed in those short dresses and all. A real flapper. Women around here were scandalized with all her city ways and manners. Men, though, liked her well enough, I'll tell you. Red hair and the devil in her blue eyes. Used to draw a regular crowd down at the hotel swimming pool when she'd come down. Well, she liked it here in the mountains, so they spent the summers here. Back then, this area was pretty lively. Tourists came from all over to spend their vacations here. Used to be some big fancy resort hotels and all the cottages, too. Yep, this place was real busy back before they opened the park. Well, Renee was a little too much woman for David Reagan, they said. Anyway, summer of 1925, she took up with one of the tourists. Good-looking fellow named Sam Luttle, staying the summer at a resort hotel near here. Far as anyone can say, David Reagan must have found out about them. You know how gossip gets around. So one day, Renee just plain vanished. Before anyone really noticed she was missing, David Reagan, one night, drove his Packard off the side of the mountain. Remember seeing that one, threw him through the windshield, and his head was just about cut loose. When Renee didn't show up, they got to searching for her, but nothing ever did turn up with that girl. Disappeared without a trace. Since David Reagan was known to have a mean temper and a jealous streak besides, folks sort of figured he found out about his wife and Sam Luttle, so he killed Renee and hid her body out somewhere in the mountains. All that pine forest, they never could find her. Some figured maybe she'd run off with Luttle, but he claimed he didn't know a thing. Anyway, he got chewed up by a bear out walking one night not long afterwards. So there wasn't nobody left who knew anything about the business. David Reagan had a brother who sold the cabin, and it's been passed around and rented ever since. And have there been stories since then of ghosts or something in connection with the place? Somehow the idea did not seem as absurd as it should have. Nope, can't say there was, acknowledged Lonzo, his expression guarded. Not much of anything unusual gone on at the Reagan place. Nobody's ever cared to keep the place for too long, for one reason or another. Still, the only thing you might call mysterious was that artist fellow back in the early 50s. Artist? What about him? Some New York fellow. Had some disease, I think. Kind of strange, crazy in the head, you could say, maybe. Anyway, he killed himself after living there a few weeks. Cut his throat with a razor. And didn't find him for a week. Had trouble renting the place for a while after that, you can guess. Fellow's name was, Enzer Pittman. Janet seemed disgustingly solicitous during dinner, going out of her way to avoid mention of Jerry's long absence that afternoon. She had fixed with steak one of his favorites, and her eyes were reproachful when he gave her curt, noncommittal answers to her attempts at conversation. If only she wouldn't be so overbearing in her attempts to please him, Jerry thought, then act like a whipped dog when he didn't respond effusively. Dutifully, he helped her clear away the dishes, even dried while she washed. Afterward, she offered to play gin rummy, but he knew she really didn't like the game and declined. Conversation grew more dismal, and when Janet seemed disposed to get romantic, he turned on the TV. Presently, he lamely mentioned paperwork and left Janet protesting her loneliness. He thought she was crying again, and the familiar flash of anger returned as he descended the precipitous stairs. Anyway, she'd perk up for the Doris Day flick. Drink in hand, Jerry once again studied the strange painting which had captured his imagination. E. Pittman, 1951. Answer Pittman, who had once stayed here and committed suicide. Artists were never stable types. But why had he painted a woman dressed in the fashion of a quarter century previous? Renee. Jerry felt certain that this Renee was the unfortunate Renee Reagan, who had probably been murdered by her jealous husband in his cabin years before. Of course, Pittman had discovered an old photograph. Certainly he would have learned of the cabin's tragic past, and the photograph of the murdered woman would have appealed to his artistic imagination. A mind on the brink of suicide would have found sick gratification in the portrayal of a murdered temptress from a decadent period like the 20s. She was a beautiful creature. It was easy to see how much beauty could drive a man to adultery or murder. Easy to understand why Pittman had been fascinated as an artist. Moodily as he stared at the painting, she was so vital. Pittman must have indeed been talented to incarnate such life within the oils. Strange how her eyes looked into your own, her smile. If you looked long enough, you could imagine her lips moved, her eyes followed you. Amazing that he had painted it from only a photograph. She would have been easy to love, mysterious, and a shallow housewife like Janet. Strange how things had changed. Once he had loved Janet because she was a perfect housewife and mother. A woman like Renee he would have considered dangerous, trivial, desirable perhaps like a film sex goddess, but not the type to love. So old values can change. And Jerry realized he no longer loved his wife. Bitterness flooded his mind. Guilt? Should he feel guilty for treating Janet so callously? Was it wrong to be unforgiving over an accident? A simple accident that... "You killed my son," he choked. Tears of rage, of pain, blinded his eyes. With a sob, Jerry whirled from the painting and flung his empty glass through the doorway of the bar. He froze, never hearing his glass rip through the rusty veranda screen and shatter against a tree below. Renee, she was standing in the doorway. Only for a second did the image last. For an instant, he clearly saw her standing before him, watching him from the darkness of the doorway. She was just like her picture, green summer frock, bobbed flame hair, eyes alight with longing, mouth half open in invitation. Then, as his heart stuttered at the vision, she vanished. Jerry let out his breath with a long exclamation and sank into a chair. Had he seen a ghost? Had they started bottling LSD with scotch? He laughed shakily. An after image, of course. He'd been staring at the painting for an hour. When he had abruptly looked away against the darkened doorway, the image of the painting had superimposed on his retina, certainly. They'd done experiments like that in college science. It had been unnerving for a second. So that was how haunted houses got their reputation. He glanced about him. The porch was deserted, of course. The wind still whispered its cold breath through the rhythmically swaying pines. Again came a faint scent of jasmine on the night air. God, it was so peaceful here, so cold and lonely. He closed his eyes and shivered, unreasonably content for the moment. Like being alone with someone you love very much. Just the two of you and the night. Jerry, for God's sake, are you all right? He catapulted out of the rocker. What? What? Of course I am. Damn it all. Stop screaming. What's wrong with you? Janet was at the top of the staircase. She called down half in relief, half in alarm. Well, I heard a glass smash and you didn't answer when I called you at first. I was afraid you'd fallen or something and maybe you were hurt. I was about to start down these steps if you hadn't answered. Jerry groaned and said with ponderous patience, Well, I'm all right, thank you. Just dropped a glass. Turn down the television next time and maybe I'll hear you. The TV's off. So that was why she took time to think of him. It started acting crazy again like last night. Can you take a look at it now? It always seems to work okay in the daytime. She paused and sniffed loudly. Jerry, do you smell something? Just mountain flowers, why? No. I mean, do you smell something rotten? Can't you smell it? I've noticed this several times at night. It smells like something dead is in the cabin. Jerry had been trying to move an old trunk when he found the diary. The rusty footlocker had been shoved into one of the closets upstairs, and Janet insisted that he lug the battered eyesore downstairs. Jerry grumbled while dragging the heavy locker to the stairs, but its lock was rusted tight, and he was unable to remove the junk inside first. So it was with grim amusement that he watched the trunk slip from his grasp and careen down the narrow stairs. At the bottom, it burst open like a rotten melon and dumped its musty contents across the floor. Clothes and books mostly. A squirrel had chewed entrance at one point and shredded most of it, while mildew had ruined the remainder. Jerry righted the broken trunk and carelessly tossed the scattered trash back inside. Let someone else decide what to do with it. There was a leather-bound notebook. Its cover was thrown back, and he noticed the title page. Diary, Enser Pittman, June, December, 1951. Jerry looked at the footlocker in alarm. Were these the possessions of that artist left unclaimed after his suicide? He set the diary aside until he had cleared away the rest of the debris. Then he succumbed to morbid curiosity and sat down to thumb through the artist's journal. Some of the pages had been chewed away, others were welded together with mold and crumbled as he tried to separate them. But he could read enough to fasten his attention to the tattered diary. The first few entries were not especially interesting. Mostly gloomy comments on the war in Korea and the witch hunts at home, the stupidity of his agent, and what a bitch Arlene was. On June 27, Pittman had arrived at the Crow's Nest for a rest and to try his hand at mountainscapes. From that point, certain passages of the diary assumed a chilling fascination for Jerry. June 28th, went out for a stroll through the woods today, surprisingly without getting lost or eaten by bears. Splendid pine forest. After New York's hollow, sterile canyons, this is fantastic. God, how strange to be alone. I walked for hours without seeing a human, a soul, and the carpet of pine needles, so unlike that interminable asphalt concrete desert. Pure desolation. I feel reborn. Extraordinary, those pines. Can't recall any sound so lonely as the wind whispering through their branches. Weird, after New York's incessant, mind-rotting clamor. If I can only express this solitude, this unearthly loneliness on canvas. Fowler is an odious cretin. Landscapes are not trite. Rather, the expression has cloyed. June 30th. Haven't found those flowers yet. Guess the night breeze carries the scent a long way. Didn't know jasmine grew here. Weird. At night, it almost feels like a woman's perfume. July 2nd. The horns are growing. Several times at night, now I've definitely sensed a woman's presence in the darkness. Strange how my imagination can almost give substance to shadow. I can almost make myself visualize her just at the corner of my vision. July 4th. Wow. Too much wine of the gods, Enzer. Last time I'd get patriotic. A little excess of Chianti to celebrate the glorious 4th. I drop off in my chair and Jesus. Wake up to see a girl bending over me. Nice trick, too. Look like something out of a held illustration. Vanished about the time my eyes could focus. I wonder what Freud would say to that. July 7th. Either this place is haunted or I'm going to have to go looking for that proverbial farmer's daughter. Last night I woke up with a distinct impression that there was a woman in bed beside me. Scared? Christ, like a childhood nightmare. I was actually afraid to reach over, even turn my head to look, and find if someone was really there. When I finally did check, nothing, of course. I almost imagined I could see depression on the mattress. The old gray matter is starting to short out. The next several pages were too mutilated to decipher and Jerry pieced together, the rest only with extreme difficulty. Seems to know the whole story, though it's hard to say how much the good reverend doth impart. Banner's a real character, strictly old-time evangelist. Mostly the same story as Pennybacker's and the other loafers, except Reverend Banner seems to have known Luttle somewhat. Renee was a woman of Satan, but to him doubtless any fancy city woman would reek of sin and godlessness. Anyway, his version is that she married Reagan for the bread, but planned to keep her hand in all the same. She seduced Sam Luttle and drove him from the path of righteousness into the morass of sinfulness and adultery. In Banner's opinion, Renee only got half a page missing. No trace of Renee's body was ever discovered. Still, it was assumed Reagan had murdered her, since she never turned up again in Greenville or anywhere else. And Reagan seemed definitely to have been on the run when he drove off the mountain. Here Banner gets a bit vague, and it's hard to tell if he's just getting his theatrical. Still, he insists that when they found Reagan with his throat guillotined by the windshield, there wasn't a tenth as much blood spilled about the body as would be expected. Some regarding Luttle's death. Superficial scratches, except the torn throat, and only a small pool of blood. Banner doesn't believe the bare explanation. But I don't get what? Pages missing. Know whether my mind is going or whether this cabin is actually haunted. July 15th. I saw her again last night. This time, she was standing at the edge of the pines beyond the front door. Seemed to be looking at me. The image lasted maybe 15-20 seconds this time, long enough to get a good look. She's a perfect likeness of the description of Renee. This is really getting bizarre. I am quite sure whether I should be frightened or fascinated. I wonder why there haven't been any other reports of this place being haunted. July 16. I've started to paint her. Wonder what Fowler will say to a portrait of a ghost. It's getting easier now to see her, and she stays visible longer, too. Maybe she's getting accustomed to me. God, I keep thinking of that old ghost story, the Beckoning Fair one. Hope this won't. July 17. I find I can concentrate on Renee at nights now, and she appears more readily, more substantial. Painting is progressing well. She seems interested. Think I'll try to talk with her next. Still unsure whether this is psychic phenomenon or paranoid hallucination. We'll see. Meanwhile, damned if Enzer will let anyone else in on this. Though aren't artists supposed to be mad? July 18. Decided to use the pines for background. Took a long walk this afternoon. Strange to think that Renee probably lies in an unmarked grave, somewhere under this carpet of pine needles. Lonely grave. No wonder she doesn't rest. She smiles when she comes to me. My little spirit remained all of 5 to 6 minutes last night. Tonight, pages missing. To no one other than myself, and I think I understand. This goes back to something Bach once talked about. Spirits inhabit a plane other than our own, another dimension, say. Most spirits and most mortals are firmly anchored to their separate worlds. Exceptions exist. Certain spirits retain some ties with this world. Renee, presumably because of her violent death, secret grave, who knows? The artist also less firmly linked to this humdrum mortal plane. His creativity, his imagination transcends the normal world. That I am more sensitive to manifestations of another plane than others. Renee is more readily perceived than other spirits. Result? Our favorite insane artist sees ghosts where countless dullards slept soundly. By this line of reasoning, anyone can become a bona fide junior ghost watcher if something occurs to make him more susceptible to their manifestations. Madman, psychic adepts, the dying, those close to the deceased, those who have been torn loose from their normal life pattern. For maybe half the night, I think I'm falling in love with her. Talk about the ultimate in necrophilia. July 26. The painting is almost complete. Last night she stayed with me almost until dawn. She seems far more substantial now. Too substantial for a ghost. Wonder if I'm just getting more depth at perceiving her, or whether Renee is growing more substantial with my belief in her. July 27. She wanted me to follow her last night. I walked maybe a mile through the dark pines before my nerves failed. Maybe she was taking me to her grave. It's auditory now. Last night, I heard her footsteps. I'll swear she leaves tracks in the dust, leaves an impression on the cushions when she sits. She watches me, listens. Only no words yet. Maybe till night she'll speak. She smiles when I tell her I love her. July 28. I swear I heard her speak. Renee said she loved me. She wants me to return her love. Only a few words just before she disappeared into the pines. And she seemed as substantial as any living girl. Either I'm hopelessly insane, or I'm on the verge of an unthinkable psychic discovery. Tonight I'm going to know for certain. Tonight I'm going to touch Renee. I'm going to hold her in my arms and not let her go until I know whether I'm mad, the victim of an incredible hoax, or a man in love with a ghost. It was the last entry. Lonzo Pennybacker gave directions to the house of the elderly Baptist preacher. Eventually, Jerry found the right dirt road and drove up to a well-kept house at the head of a mountain cove. Flowers bloomed in the yard and dogs were having a melee with a pack of noisy children. The house presented a clean, honest front, a far cry from the squalor Jerry had expected in a mountain home. Reverend Billy Banner sat in a porch rocker and rose to meet Jerry. He was an alert man in his 70s or better, lean and strong. Without a trace of weakness or senility, his eyes were clear and his voice still carried the deep intonations that had rained hellfire and damnation on his congregation for decades. After shaking hands, Banner motioned him to a chair, politely waited for his guest to come to business. This was difficult. Jerry was uncertain what questions to ask, what explanations to offer, or what he really wanted to find out. But Banner sensed his uneasiness and expertly drew from him the reason for his visit. Jerry explained he was staying at the old Reagan cabin, that he was interested in the artist Enzer Pittman who had killed himself there. "Enzer Pittman?" the old man nodded. "Yes, I remember him well enough. He paid me a visit once, just like you today, maybe for the same reason." Plunging on, Jerry asked about the history of the cabin and was told little he had not already learned. Reverend Banner spoke with reluctance of the old tragedy, seemed to suspect more than he was willing to put into words. "Do you have any idea what might have driven Pittman to suicide?" Jerry asked finally. The preacher kept silent until Jerry wondered if he would ignore the question. "Suicide?" "That was the verdict, sure enough. They found him, mother naked in bed. His throat tore open and a razor beside him. Been dead a few days. Likely it's been done the last of July. No sign of struggle, nothing gone, no enemies. artists are kind of funny anyway. Some claimed he had cancer. So maybe it was suicide, like the coroner said. Maybe not. Was there much blood on the sheets for a man to be cut like that, they tell me. All the same, I hope it was suicide, not something worse. I thought suicide was the unforgivable sin. There's nothing worse, Banner looked at him shrewdly. Maybe you know what I mean. The Bible talks about witches and ghosts and a lot of other things we think we're too wise to believe in today. That Renee Reagan was a daughter of Satan, sure as I'm sitting here remembering her. Well, I'm an old man, but no one's ever called me an old fool, so I'll just stop talking. Feeling uncomfortable without knowing why, Jerry thanked the preacher and rose to go. Reverend Banner stood up to see him off, then laid a sinewy hand on his shoulder at the edge of the porch. I don't know just what sort of trouble you got that's bothering you, son, he began, fixing Jerry with his keen eye. But I do know there's something about the old Reagan place that gets to some kind of people. If that's the way it is with you, then you better get back to where it is you come from. And if you do stay on here, just remember that evil can't harm a righteous man so long as he denies its power and holds to the way of our Lord Jesus Christ and his gospel. But once you accept evil, once you let evil into your life and permit its power to influence your soul, then it's got your body and soul, and you're only a plaything for all the devils of hell. You've got that lost look about you, son. Maybe you can hear that hellbound train a-calling to you. But don't you listen to its call, son. Don't you climb on board. With a strange mixture of dread and anticipation, Jerry broke away from Janet's mawkish attempt to make conversation and retired to the lower veranda for the evening. All afternoon he had thought about returning to Columbus, forgetting this mystery, yet he knew he could not. For one thing, he had to stay until he could be certain of his own sanity. Barring madness, this entire uncanny business must either be a hoax or genuine. If it were an elaborate hoax, Jerry wanted to know who, how, and why. And if the cabin was haunted, he had to know. But it was deeper than the simple desire to explore an occult phenomenon. Renee, whoever, whatever she might be, held a profound fascination for him. Her image obsessed him. He thought of this passionate, exotic woman of another era. Then there was Janet. Bitterness returned, and again the memory of the sun and the ordered world her moronic carelessness had torn from him. Right now, she was sitting like a mushroom, spellbound by that boob tube, never a concern for her husband's misery. His thoughts were of Renee when sleep overcame him. In dream he saw her drift through the screen door and greet him with red-lipped smile. She was so vivacious, so desirable. Pittman's painting had held only the shadow of her feline beauty. Gracefully, she poured two fingers of Jerry Scotch and tossed it down neat, eyes wide with devilish challenge. Bringing the bottle with her, she took the chair beside his own. Her long fingers cozily touched his arm. "Nice of you to offer a lady a drink," she grinned impishly. "Good scotch is so hard to get now. Been saving this stuff in your cellar since before Volstead, or is this just off the boat?" "Oh, the prohibition's been repealed for years now," Jerry heard himself say dully, as if in a dream. It was a dream. Renee cast no reflection in the barroom mirror. "Sure, honey," she laughed teasingly. "Say, lover, you look all down in the dumps tonight. Care to tell a girl all about it?" And Jerry began to tell Renee the story of his life. As the night grew deeper, he told her of his struggle to become successful in his work, his efforts to build a position for himself in society, his marriage to a woman who couldn't understand him, his son for whom he had hoped everything, Janet's accident and the death of all his aspirations. Quietly she listened to him, eyes intent with sympathy. God, why couldn't Janet ever show such feeling, such interest? always too busy feeling sorry for herself. When he finished, mechanical sobs shook his angular frame. Renee expressed a wordless cry of concern and laid a white arm around his shoulder. "Hey, come on now, Jerry. Get it all out of your system. You've really had a tough break or two, but we can work it out now, can't we? Here now, think about this instead." She slithered onto his lap and captured his lips in a long kiss. Somewhere in the kiss, Jerry opened his eyes. With a gasp, he started from his chair. No one was there, of course. God, what a dream! His lips felt bruised and naturally cold. Even her kiss had felt real. Got to go easy on the bottle. Still, if this was DT's, it was pleasant enough. God, had he ever carried on, that psychiatrist would have had a picnic. He reached for the scotch. Empty. Had he that much to drink? No wonder the dream. Was it a dream? Jerry looked about him suspiciously. The chair beside him seemed maybe closer, although he really hadn't noticed it earlier. An empty glass on the floor, but maybe he'd left it there before. That peculiar scent of jasmine again. Wonder what perfume Renee had worn? Observed, it was mountain flowers. He touched his lips and there was blood on his fingers. "I'm going out for a walk," he told Janet after breakfast. "Can't you stay around here today for a change?" she asked wistfully. "Oh, let's go someplace together. You've been off too much lately. I hardly get to see you. And it's so lonely here without anyone around." "Without a phone to gossip with all the bitches in your bridge club," he snapped. "Well, I'm not sitting on my ass all afternoon watching television. If you want company, then walk along with me." "Jerry," she began shakily, "you know I can't." "No, I don't know. The doctors say you can walk whenever you want to. You're just so content playing the invalid, you won't even try to walk again." Her eyes clouded. "Jerry, that was cruel." "The truth, though, wasn't it?" he exploded. "Well, damn it. Snap out of it. I'm getting disgusted with waiting on you hand and foot, tying myself down to someone who can't stop feeling sorry for herself long enough to..." "Jerry!" Janet clenched her fist. "Stop it! What's happening to us? For the last several days, you've been getting even sharper with me. You shun me, avoid my company, like you hated me. For God's sake, Jerry, what is the matter?" He turned from her in wordless contempt and strode off into the pine forest. She called after him until he was beyond earshot. The pines. How restful they were after her miserable whimpering. The dense shade, the deep carpet of fallen needles choked out undergrowth. The dark, straight trunk stabbed towards the sunlight above, leaving a rough shaft branchless for dozens of feet. It was so pleasant to walk among them. The needles were resilient carpet that deadened all sound. The trunks were myriad pillars to support a vaulted ceiling of swaying green boughs. It was eerie here in the pines, so unlike a hardwood forest, alive with crackling leaves and a wild variety of trees and underbrush. The pines were so awesome, so ancient, so desolate. The incredible loneliness of the twilight wilderness assailed Jerry and strangely soothed the turmoil of his emotions. The restless wind moved the branches above him in ceaseless song, sighing, whispering pines. Here was the sound of loneliness. Again, Jerry recalled the old mountain folk tune. "The longest train I ever saw was 100 coaches long, and the only girl I ever loved was on that train and gone. In the pines, where the sun never shines, and I shiver when the wind blows cold." What was happening to him? A year ago, he would have laughed at the absurd idea of ghosts or haunted houses. Had he changed so much since then? Since the accident? No, this couldn't actually be happening to him. He must try to examine all the facts with the same clear down-to-earth attitude he formerly would have taken. He had come here with his nerves in bad shape, on the verge of a breakdown. The doctors had implied that he'd found an unusual painting and read through the diary of a deranged artist. Nerves and too much scotch had got the best of his disordered imagination, and he had assumed the same delusions as poor Pittman. Add to that the stories of the place he had gleaned from the locals, and his newborn romantic streak had run wild, to the point he was sharing Pittman's own mad hallucinations. Similarities were not surprising, and the circumstances that induced the delusions were the same, and he had Pittman's notes to direct him. Besides, if the Reagan place were haunted, why had no one else seen anything out of the ordinary? Pittman, in his egotism, had claimed his artistic soul made it possible for him to perceive what lesser minds had missed. But Jerry had no artistic pretensions or illusions of paranormal talents. Pittman had suggested that someone might become susceptible to the spirit world if he had somehow become alienated from his normal plane of existence. Jerry shrugged mentally. Perhaps then he had become receptive to the other world when the protection of his safe middle-class existence had collapsed about him. But now, he was accepting the logic of a suicide. He paused in bewilderment. The pine forest had suddenly assumed a sense of familiarity. Curiously, Jerry studied his surroundings. Then it occurred to him, granted the passage of time, this section of the forest resembled the background in the painting of Rene. He had half assumed Pittman had done a stylized portrait rather than its actual landscape. How odd to happen upon the same grove of pines and then to recognize it from the painting. Why had Pittman chosen this particular section of the pines? Probably he had simply wandered to the spot just as Jerry had done. Still, perhaps there was something that made this spot especially attractive to the artist. Jerry stood in silence. Was it imagination again? Did the sun seem to shine less brightly here? Did the pines seem to loom darker with a shadow of menace? Was the whisper of the pines louder here? And was there a note of depravity in the loneliness of the sound? Why were there no cries of birds, no sounds of life, other than the incessant murmur of the brooding pines? And why was there a bare circle of earth where not even the pines grew? Jerry shivered. He hurried from the spot, no longer so certain of his logic. Janet was sulking when Jerry returned, and they studiously avoided each other for the remainder of the day. Monosyllables were exchanged when conversation was unavoidable, and whatever went through the mind of either was left to fester unexpressed. Mechanically, Janet prepared dinner, although neither felt like eating. "I can't take this," Janet finally blurted. "I don't know what's happened to us since we got here, but we're tearing ourselves apart. This just hasn't worked for us, Jerry. Tomorrow I want to go home." Jerry sighed ponderously. "Now look, we came here so you could rest, and now already you want to go back? Jerry, I can't stand it here. Every day I felt you grow further and further away from me. I don't know if it's just this place or if it's us, but I do know we've got to leave." "We'll talk about it in the morning," he said wearily and stood up. Janet's lips were set. "Right. Now go downstairs and drink yourself to sleep. That's the pattern, isn't it? You can't bear to be around me, so you get as far away as you can, and you stumble around all day, either drunk or hungover, always bleary-eyed, paunchy, and surly. Jerry, I can't take this any longer." He retreated stolidly. "Go to bed, Janet. We'll talk this over in the morning." "Damn it, Jerry, I've tried to be patient. The doctors warned me you'd made an unhealthy adjustment to the accident just because you came out no worse than hungover. But if this doesn't stop, I'm going to ask for separation." Jerry halted. Angry retorts poised on his tongue. "No, let her yell. Ignore her. Good night, Janet," he grated and fled downstairs. Angrily, he gulped down half a glass of straight scotch. God, this scotch was the only thing that held their marriage together, made the situation tolerable, and he noticed his stock of scotch was just about gone. Divorce? Well, why not? Let the leech live off alimony for the rest of her years. It was almost worth paying to be rid of her. Let her divorce him then. She made a ruin of everything else in his life. Might as well finish the job, right? Once again he thought of Renee. There was a woman to love, to desire. A woman who could stand on her own 2 feet, would return his love with full passion of her own. She and Janet shared their sex with no more in common than a leopardess and a cow. No wonder Pittman had fallen in love with his fantasy of Renee. Damn Janet. Damn the doctors. Bitching him about his emotional stability. So he drank more than he used to. So he maybe threw a scene or two. Maybe felt a little differently about things now. Well, it was a different world. A man was entitled to make adjustments. Maybe he needed a little more time. No, it wasn't his fault. The glass slipped from his shaking fist, smashed on the floor. Jerry pawed at it clumsily, cursing the spilled liquor. He'd fix another and clear up tomorrow. Dully, he noticed another broken glass. When had he? It was late when Jerry finally drifted off to sleep, as had become his habit. Smiling, he welcomed Renee when she came to him. How strange to be dreaming, he mused. And yet, no, that it is a dream. Here again, darling, there was secret humor in her grave smile, and looking so sad again. What are we to do with you, Jerry? I so hate to see you all alone in a blue funk every night. The wife? Janet, the bitch, he mumbled thickly. She wants me to leave you. Renee was dismayed. Leave? When I'm just getting so fond of you? Hey, lover, that sounds pretty grim. Brokenly, Jerry blurted out his anger, his pain. Told her of the lies and insinuations. Told her how hard it was to get through each day. How only a stiff drink and the memory of her smile could calm his nerves each night. Renee listened in the silence, only nodding to show she understood until he finished and sat quivering with anger. It sounds to me like you finally realized Janet has only been a nagging obstruction in your life, she observed. Surely you never loved her. Jerry nodded vehemently. I hate her. She smiled lazily and snuggled closer, her lips only inches from his own. What about me, Jerry? Do you love your Renee? His Renee? With all my soul, he whispered huskily. That's sweet. Renee held him with her glowing eyes. So you love Renee more than Janet? Yes, of course I do. And would you like to be rid of Janet so you could be with me? God, how I wish that. Her smile burned more confident. What if she died? Would you want Janet dead? Bitterness poisoned his spirit. Janet dead? Yes, that would be perfect. I wish you were dead so we could be together. Oh, sweetheart, Renee squeezed him delightedly. You really do love me, don't you? Let's kiss in our bargain. Somewhere in her kiss, the dream dissolved to blackness. From upstairs, a shriek of black terror shattered the stillness of the night. He started awake some time later, groggily rubbed his head while trying to collect his thoughts. What had happened? The dream. He remembered, and suddenly he had the feeling that something was wrong, dreadfully wrong. Strangely frightened, he staggered up the stairs. Janet! He called, his voice unnatural. Moonlight spilled through the rusty screen and highlighted the crumpled figure who lay in one corner of the room. A small patch of darkness glistened on the wood. Strange how small that pool of blood. Janet! He groaned in disbelieving horror. Oh, my God! Her eyes were wide and staring, her face set in a death grimace of utmost loathing, insane dread. Whatever had killed Janet had first driven her mad with terror. It had not been an easy death. Her throat was a jagged gash, too ragged a tear for the knife that lay beside her, a Barlow knife, his. Janet, he sobbed, grief slamming him like a sledge. Who could have done this thing? Don't you know, lover? Jerry whirled, cried out in fear. Renee, you're alive! She laughed at him from the shadow, triumph's light in her eyes. She was just as he had seen her in the painting, in the dreams. Green silk frock, bobbed auburn hair, eyes that held dark secrets. Only now her lips were far more crimson, and scarlet trickled across her chin. "Yes, Jerry, I'm alive, and Janet is dead. Just the way you wished. Or have you forgotten?" Mockery was harsh in her voice. "Impossible," he moaned. "You've been dead for years. Ghosts can't exist. Not here, not today." But Renee stepped forward, gripped his hand with fingers like frozen steel. Her nails stabbed his wrist. "You know better." Jerry stared at her in revulsion. "I don't believe in you. You have no power over me." "But you do believe in me. God help me. Help me," he sobbed, mind reeling with nightmare. Contempt lined her face. "Too late for that." She pulled his arm, drew him to the door. "Come now, lover. We have a sealed bargain." He protested, willed himself not to follow, struggled to awaken from the nightmare. In vain. Helplessly he followed the creature he himself had given substance. Out into the pines Renee led him, the pines whose incessant whisper told of black knowledge and secret loneliness. Through the desolate pines they walked into the night, past endless columns of dark sentinel trunks, swaying, whispering an ancient rhythm with the night wind. Until they came to a grove Gerard Randall now found familiar, where the whisper was louder and resonant with doom, where the pines drew back about a circle of earth in which nothing grew, where tonight yawned a pit, and he knew where Renee's unhallowed grave lay hidden. "Is this madness?" he asked with sudden hope. "No, this is death." And the illusion of beauty slipped from Renee, revealed the caverned-eyed lich in rotting silk, who pulled him down into the grave like a bride enticing a bashful groom. And in that final moment Gerard Randall understood the whispering litany of the merciless pines.